You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Aminata Forna's new novel, The Memory of Love, is set in the West African country of Sierra Leone, one of the poorest places in the world. Against the backdrop of its long civil war, a young African doctor, an English psychologist, and an elderly professor find their lives connected through one woman. The Memory of Love received rave reviews when it was published in Britain last year. Now it's being made available in the United States by Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Aminata Forna to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You alternate between two different time periods, 1969, around the time of the moon landing, and the recent past after the 11-year civil war. Why those two times?
I set it in two different time periods because what I wanted to examine in the novel was really the prelude and aftermath of war, how a country implodes. Of course, Sierra Leone and any country that goes to war gets a lot of attention at the time. But, of course, these things don't come out of nowhere. And for 25 years before the war in Sierra Leone, the country had been gradually sliding downhill. It's a case of looking at those million, billion tiny acts that eventually result in a country losing its way.
Well, the war lasted from 1991 to 2002. Is the situation much better in Sierra Leone today?
It's considerably better. I mean, certainly in terms of personal security, I drive up and down the country all the time and I feel very safe. We all felt very safe there before the war. So that's a thing that I think the outsiders find hard to understand, how safe we felt, how astonished we were by the fact that we had gone to war. We saw the war in Liberia. We never thought it would happen to us, and yet it did.
Well, to some degree, this was a war that spilled over from Liberia, wasn't it? Because Charles Taylor was supporting the revolutionary group, the RUF.
That's right. And some people do call it an invasion. And the RUF was made up of young men and women from the entire region, from Burkina Faso, Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone. But, you know, if Sierra Leone hadn't had the problems that it did have, if we hadn't so many disenfranchised young people, it would never have caught fire.
Well, it's a country with a lot of great natural resources, especially diamonds, and some of the worst poverty in the world. That was a problem even before.
It's always been a problem. And actually, the diamonds are a curse. They're not a benefit. They make it, well, a natural resource like that that is so easily seized and used by men in power to keep themselves in power. Of course, it's not much good to a country.
Charles Taylor winds up handing a few of them to a famous model.
Allegedly.
How many people died in the war? Do we know?
I don't think we have a figure, but it would be tens of thousands.
It's 50,000 is the estimate that I've read. And then, of course, many were maimed, some quite severely. And there were also kidnappings and rapes and millions displaced. It must have been – did you live through much of that?
I wasn't there. I was in the States for part of it, and I was in Britain. But my whole family went through it. My mum was there for both invasions of Freetown. I remember talking to her on the phone, and I could hear the gun battle going on outside. And then we were cut off because a shell had landed on the telephone exchange, and I didn't hear from her again for several weeks. So it was a very, very anxious time for everybody.
Sierra Leoneans have been described as the world's most resilient people. But at one point, one of your characters quotes a study that says 99% of the people in Sierra Leone suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. It's hard to be resilient under those circumstances.
And actually, another character says to him, what you call trauma, we call life. I mean, this is what what amazes me about people in those kinds of societies. It's not just Sierra Leone. I was in the Balkans recently talking to people there about their civil war. The parallels are extraordinary. What preceded it, what happened during it, absolutely extraordinary. And they too felt it would never happen to them. They saw it going on in Crimea, never thought it would happen in any of the other states. So what fascinates me really is that courage to endure. We think of courage as being the courage of great acts, but the extraordinary courage that I see in these places and in my home country of Sierra Leone is this courage to keep on going.
Well, in the Balkans, we had the breakup of Yugoslavia with a number of different ethnic groups, all who didn't even have the same alphabet vying for power. But in Sierra Leone, this is a country that pretty much has two languages, English and Creole. No,
it's got 13 languages.
No, I understand there are indigenous languages, but everybody speaks those too, would you?
No, they don't. They don't actually. No, Freetown, they speak Creole, and not that many people speak English. But I think the parallels with the Balkans are, I mean, when I look at the Balkans, I think, okay, they had a financial crisis, but they weren't as poor as we were. So what was their excuse, you know? But there's a writer, a Nobel laureate, Ivo Pavic, I think, from the former Yugoslavia, and he wrote a wonderful book called Letter to a Friend, an essay called Letter to a Friend, and he writes about the fact that the hate was always there. And I think one has to be aware of that in a society.
And that was true in Sierra Leone too?
The despair turned into hatred, you know, of the people who had nothing towards those who had too much.
Well, the whites in Sierra Leone complain, in your book anyway, that the Africans are too resigned and passive. I would assume that is an attitude they felt they needed to survive.
I would say so. It's part of resilience. And, of course, it isn't always – it's not a proactive quality, but it is something. What people do in Sierra Leone is they say, it's God's will, it's God's – well, I mean, not just in Sierra Leone, you hear that all over the place, don't you? It's God's will. And it can be frustrating to listen to, because sometimes you feel like saying, come on, we need to do something about this. But if you feel you are powerless, perhaps that is the response that keeps you sane.
And you describe it as a hot, dusty place. What's the climate like?
Of course, it's a character who describes it as a hot. I think it's Adrian, who has never been there before, and to him, it's incredibly hot. I mean, I don't mind the heat in the slightest, but yeah, red dust. You know, those countries on that belt, you get the Harmattan dust coming down from the Sahara. So there are times of year when everything is covered in dust.
So is this an area threatened by the Sahara, the growth of the Sahara, and the drought?
We've certainly suffered a lot of climate change, a lot of the effects of climate change, but we are an equatorial climate. But all of that belt of Africa is suffering badly.
In your novel, the African doctor Kai Mansere and the English psychologist Adrian Lockhart work in a hospital in Freetown, the capital. And what's their mission there?
Kai is an orthopedic surgeon, and he is there to literally mend bodies. It's his country and that's his profession, and he's dedicated. Adrian is a psychologist who has been seconded there for a year, and of course he is in the business of attempting to help minds. I was very interested in contrasting those two different kinds of ways of helping, and indeed Adrian and Kai struggle and sometimes argue about it.
Because the Civil War presents problems in both areas. Many people... he has to deal with machete wounds, for example, the African doctor. In fact, and you describe being in an operating room. Did you actually research it by going into an operating room?
You know,
they dealt with those kinds of wounds?
I ended up in a hospital in Sierra Leone in 2004 after I broke my Achilles tendon doing a very, very foolish thing, running on a beach. And it wasn't my proudest moment. I ended up in the hospital for war victims and amputees. It was the only really functioning hospital that there was there at the time. The state hospital was in a terrible state. But even when I was there on the gurney being attended, I thought this was an extraordinary place because it was a place of absolute calm, absolute order, where everybody was engaged in the same mission, which was the saving of lives. It was the contrast to everything that was going on outside. So I went back and, yes, I watched quite a few operations. And the operating theatre was, to me, the epicentre of this place of order and calm. And it struck me as a character moving between those two zones, out of war, chaos, into calm. That struck me as an exciting counterpoint.
Why was maiming so common during the war?
Well, maiming is common it's a feature of civil war, and of course it happened in the former Yugoslavia as well. Interesting.
But not the kinds of amputations that we saw.
Well, actually, an awful lot of atrocities. One thing is that if you cut off somebody's hand, especially a young man's hand, that's one soldier down. one less person to fight back. But crucially, and what we now know about that war in Sierra Leone, because of the special court, in fact, somebody actually asked the question, is that it was deliberate, a deliberate policy of cowing a civilian population. The unit was sent in ahead. They were called something like civilian relations unit. They went in ahead of the fighting forces to terrorise, you know, to rape, to burn, to terrorise, so that by the time the fighting forces came in, nobody would put up any kind of resistance. So when we look at it from the West, we think it's random acts of violence, but actually the truth is there was nothing random about it. It was conceived and executed with a chilling clarity.
You write some of the sections in the book in first person, others in third person. Why that approach?
Well, the part that's written in the first person is Elias Cole's story, and he's telling it to Adrian.
He was a lecturer at the university.
That's right.
And now he's dying?
He's dying of a lung condition in a hospital in Sierra Leone. He needs a lung transplant. He has no hope of getting one. He's telling his story to the psychologist. And I wanted Elias's story to be told straight to the reader. Adrian is, in a way, the reader. He is us. He is the outsider who doesn't know this country very well, who is learning it from Elias Cole. And he has at some point to make judgments about Elias, about his story, whether Elias is telling the own truth or whether he's rewriting his own history. As Elias's daughter at one point says, there are things about him you don't know. And I think this is what goes on in all countries where people haven't behaved with dignity and have allowed, you know, they haven't stood up for something, they haven't stood up to be counted. Things have happened, and then afterwards, what they want to do is absolve themselves. And what Elias is looking for is some kind of absolution.
Well, in one of the sections in 1969, a professor is arrested. You get the feeling that this country has never really had the kind of government that would create a stable situation. What he was arrested for, because he was suspected of having wrong political ideas?
Exactly, you know, and that was typical of that time. So you could either, you know, if you could either be part of the problem or you could be part of the solution. And one has to decide what Elias is. Is he part of the problem or is he part of the solution? You know, Thomas Jefferson said, you get the government you deserve. And I used to think that was terribly harsh, having lived through so much oppression myself. And then I, as the years went by, I began to see that actually, unless we all, as we see happening in Egypt, if people don't stand up for individual rights and therefore for, for a greater good, then anyone can rule us in any way that they want.
Your first book was a memoir, The Devil Who Danced on the Water, that dealt with your father. What happened to him?
Well, my father was a political prisoner. He was a political prisoner on and off throughout my childhood. He was an amnesty prisoner of conscience because he stood up to what was going on. And he was ultimately executed by the government in 1975 when I was 11.
You also wrote a novel which had to do with a cashew plantation, and you're actually creating a cashew plantation?
In the novel, it's a coffee plantation. Oh. But yes, art followed life. I mean, people imagine that I had a plantation and therefore I wrote a book with that as a setting. Actually, it went the other way round. I wrote the book, and in the book, one of the main characters inherits a plantation, and that's how she goes back to her country. And at the end of it, in fact, I was talking to my agent, and he said, well, how does the book end? And I said, oh, maybe she'll replant the coffee plantation. And it gave me an idea that this was a way in which I could help my own village with an agricultural project, which they'd been asking for some time. So together, when I'd finished the book, we set up, planted Conifer Estates. I named it after the fictional plantation in Ancestor Stones, the book.
Aminata Forna is the author of a novel, Ancestor Stones, and a memoir, The Devil That Danced on the Water. She's produced and presented several television documentaries, most recently The Lost Libraries of Timbuktu for the BBC, and her journalism has appeared in any number of British publications. Her latest is a novel called The Memory of Love. It is published in this country by Atlantic Monthly Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.